Welcome to the Election Day edition of All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's time to vote. It's time to recall the process of voting in election days past, at least as far back as 2000. That's all any of us can remember anymore. And what we've learned, how we've applied the lessons. And joining me today to do that is Michael Stinziano. He's the director of the Franklin County Board of Elections. Michael, welcome.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And also in the studio, Daniel Tokaji. He is an associate professor of law at OSU's Moritz College of Law, and he's also associate director of election law at Moritz.
Hi.
Hi, Daniel. Thanks for being here. And finally, Dia Reese. She is the executive director of the League of Women Voters of Ohio. Thank you for being here, Deidre.
Thank you, Ann. Good morning.
I guess, Mike, I wanted to kind of get started with the generalized questions of how confused are voters this year? And I'm not talking about the issues, but about the process of voting. How are we doing?
Well, I think we're doing a lot better than we have in the past. Voters seem to be understanding what they need to bring to the polls on Election Day. The biggest questions we're having that we've seen so far this morning is, where is my polling location? A lot of people voted absentee at the last presidential, might not have participated at the primary in the August special in Columbus. So this is the first chance they've had to go back out to a polling location. So we just remind everyone that they can look up their polling location at a variety of places, particularly the Board of Elections website, which is vote.franklincountyohio.gov, and that'll tell them exactly where they need to be.
As far as the absentee ballots go, how are we comparing? Well, first of all, let's talk about voter turnout in general, how it compares to the big nationwide general election and then, you know, the absentee ballots.
Well, the general election of 2008 was a record in Franklin County and pretty much across the state of Ohio. We obviously aren't seeing that for this election. We haven't seen it this year.
So what was that record? Let's just wallow in that.
We had about 250,000 early voters, both in person and absentee. Okay. 55,000 in person at Vets Memorial, and then the rest were made up by mail.
Okay. I remember those long lines at Vets Memorial last year. How did that go?
And when it went very
back,
well.
How would you do things differently?
Well, I think we would look for a larger space. I think,
who can imagine?
Right. 55,000 broke many, many records. The largest we'd ever had before was 8,000 in person. And so this was the first time we went off-site. We knew we were expecting a larger number, but we didn't expect to break 20,000. So the staff did a wonderful job. We had extended hours. That was a unique experience also in Franklin County, that we were open 7 days a week to provide that accessibility.
Don't you sometimes wish you could just have general election after general election nationwide? So because 4 years will go by before you're going to have to do that again and face those kind of numbers.
Well, yes and no.
Everything will be different.
I think we do like having the four-year break in order to tweak things, make it a little better, find larger spaces, learn lessons from what the experiences we encounter.
What are the big problems this year?
There aren't really big problems. Again, okay. It's just reminding voters where they need to be going. Obviously, we remind voters to bring ID. That's something that's always comes up, but voters are catching on to that in Ohio. My common joke is that they're understanding it a little better than the poll workers right now.
Well, let's talk about that's the main contact most people are going to have today with the whole process is with a person called a poll worker. How are they trained now?
In Franklin County, we provide training to all our poll workers for each election cycle. We give them an updated manual and we provide an updated training. It's something that wasn't as consistently done in the past, but it's a commitment we've made in Franklin County so that our poll workers do know all the changes. Obviously, a lot since even 2006 to get us to 2009, we've seen a lot of changes in Franklin County and throughout Ohio.
Now, the two big things they need to know is where to find your name on the list mm-hmm. and what kind of ID you need.
Well, and to pull up the right ballot style. Often we get some confusion where the poll workers will pull the wrong ballot style since we've joined a lot of precincts together. So you could have two or three different ballot styles in one precinct, and the poll worker needs to pay attention to that ballot style, which they'll find in the book when the voter signs their name.
Next to their name?
Yep.
What are the most common questions then? And Deidre, I know you have a phone bank at Channel 10.
Correct.
WBNS. Mm-hmm. And people can call in all day long and ask questions. Dumber the better, I guess. but between the two of you, what are the questions when people call in to ask? What are the questions you're hearing besides, is there an election today?
Actually, we have gotten that question several times this morning. But as Michael said, a lot of the questions are people looking for their polling location. They did vote by absentee ballot the last time, or they've moved, or they're concerned that their actual location has changed. Certainly, there have been some questions on, you know, what are the issues? What does a yes mean? What does a no mean? Which the league is happy to provide that information. But those are the basic questions. Where do I actually go to vote today?
Yeah, Michael.
And another common thing we're seeing are people are questioning why there aren't party affiliation listed with the candidates that are on the ballots.
Which are judges, right?
Judges, city council, school board members, and an odd year election, many of the races are nonpartisan affiliated races. While they do have political affiliation on the outside world, on the ballot and the way Ohio law reads, we don't put affiliation on. So that's not a mistake. That's not a step back. I've had a couple concerns raised with that issue as well.
Are there more new voters now than there used to be because of that surge last year? Do you have a sense that there's people out there voting for the second time in their life?
I haven't seen anything that would make me believe that. I think we've seen a lot of people, given the economy, moving. So we do have a lot of transients and people voting at new locations.
We have had many calls to our office of people who said the first time they voted was in the 2008 election and they wanted to make certain they were still registered and that sort of thing. So I think there is a sense that there's some people who are still relatively new to the process. And I even had questions like, you know, is this election even important? I know the national election was important, but is this one? How am I being affected? So there's some sense of that out there.
Okay, you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820. If you have a question, call 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Let us know, are you going to vote today? Do you bother to vote if there are no big names and big issues on the ballot? Of course, there are some pretty big issues on the ballot this year. That makes a difference. Do you think that that's having any effect on, well, you said the 20% turnout is predicted. Is that high or low, or where does that fall, Michael?
That's about average for an odd year election because there aren't really apples to apple comparisons we can do. We've kind of looked at the last time we had a statewide issue campaign. That's really what's been driving turnout so far, at least in absentee, and what we expect to drive turnout today. And that's always fallen in a 20-25% range.
Yeah. Daniel?
One of the issues to watch today is whether we see turnout disparities between counties. And on that topic, one of the things that's especially interesting is we may see more people turning out in the Cleveland area in Cuyahoga County than we do in Franklin County, because Cuyahoga County sent out absentee ballot applications to all their voters. And according to a story in the Dispatch a couple days ago, they've already gotten something like 70% of the number of applications that they had last year in Cuyahoga County, compared to only 17% here, almost certainly a result of the fact that applications were sent out directly in Cuyahoga but not here. Now, Franklin County decided not to do that for some understandable cost concern reasons, but you know, if as is expected, more folks in Cleveland than in Columbus are supporting issue three, and if it's a close election, that could well make the difference.
Michael, how does that wash when it comes to the final analysis of an election? If all the counties aren't operating on the same level in that way, how can we draw any conclusions, or what kind of conclusions should we draw if Franklin County comes in much lower on issue three?
Well, we know it's going to come in lower on issue three. In terms of just early voting and absentee, Cuyahoga is around about 180,000, and in Franklin County, we're going to be less than 50,000. And as the second largest jurisdiction, there is obviously a disparity there. In terms of what that means in the big picture, it's Ohio law provides for it. It allows for this kind of inconsistency from county to county. I think in different situations, we've tried to address that inconsistency, but it's still currently existing.
Daniel, why does the law allow for such – that's a huge inconsistency.
It's a great question, and it's one that has national implications. You know, since 2000 – as you noted earlier, we've seen a flurry of attention to the mechanics of elections. And if we think back to Florida 2000, one of the big concerns there was, hey, different ballots are being treated differently in different counties. You know, despite the fact that we have federal and statewide elections, elections by and large are still mostly administered at the local level, and local officials have a lot of discretion in terms of how they run things. And when local officials have discretion, though that has some benefits, it raises questions about statewide equality and sometimes state or federal equal protection questions, as in Bush versus Gore, that find their way into courts. In fact, the League of Women Voters brought a lawsuit several years ago that has recently been settled, alleging just such equal protection concerns in the state of Ohio. And we're never going to make things exactly uniform throughout the state, but I think this is probably one of the areas in which we can do better than we're doing.
Yeah, I would imagine access to the ballot is very measurable. Michael, how much money did the county save by not doing that?
About $350,000.
How much is the election costing us today in Franklin County?
I don't know the breakdown of today's specific election for the total for the year. Given the three elections we've had, we'll have about a $7.5 million spent.
Mm-hmm. Is that, Daniel, the costs have become an issue, obviously.
Yeah.
But how does that figure when it comes to equal protection?
Yeah.
Does the cost matter?
Hey, costs are always at the forefront of the minds of election administrators, county boards of commissioners, and boards of supervisors. And, you know, it's understandable why sometimes those government bodies decide, hey, we're going to allocate more of our scarce resources to hospitals or fire departments or law enforcement, right? Those seem to be more pressing needs. But then the ultimate consequence of that is that we have disparities and sometimes inequalities from county to county. And that can be a serious equality problem for voters.
Deidre, on the issue of whether the ballots are mailed out to everybody, does the League of Women Voters of Ohio have a recommendation on that score?
Well, we certainly understand the situation, such as what happened here in Franklin County. If the county commissioners don't provide the funds to do it, certainly the County Board of Election cannot actually carry it out. But we certainly have concerns about the disparities that happen, you know, from one county to another. Again, as Dan mentioned, that's the reason why we brought our lawsuit. We want to see equity in terms of what's going on. But we recognize it cannot happen in every place. We have some county boards where there are two people, and we have others like Franklin County that are much better staffed. But again, you can get overwhelmed. They never expected to have the turnout that they had last year. What if we had a 40% turnout today for some reason? You know, we're making predictions, but we cannot, you know, necessarily project down to an absolute of what it's going to be. So, you know, we always have to look at the system and try to provide some baseline standards and do the best we can with the data that we have.
Daniel Tokaji from Moritz School of Law, College of Law. Are there other populous counties in Ohio that also sent out the ballots to everybody?
Yeah, I know that Hamilton did. And there may be some others. Michael or Deirdre might know about this as well. But Hamilton and Cuyahoga are the two biggest ones that did send out their applications to everyone. And to the extent that others like Franklin didn't, it creates a serious issue because we're going to have more people turning out in those counties as a result.
Well, they'll turn out or they won't vote at all.
Some people who wouldn't vote will vote because of the fact that absentee ballot applications were sent to them.
Right.
Now, of course, others could, in theory, request an absentee ballot application. But I'm not suggesting that from an individual perspective there's a denial of the right to vote, but there are some serious systemic consequences that could affect the result when different counties do things differently.
Well, I suppose you could, Michael, faced the same sort of criticisms as they did in 2004 when there weren't enough machines out there. And I mean, there were people that believed there was a conspiracy, and there still are, that the machines weren't put in strategic locations where the votes likely would have gone one way or the other. And I don't know. Is that some of the criticism you've been receiving as far as sending the ballots out as well?
Well, I think a lot of people understand the circumstances.
We
are committed and strive to send out the absentee ballot applications for every election, not just a general, not just a special, not just a primary. But we have to have the proper funding to do it. We request that funding, and when it gets denied, that's our indication that there isn't a commitment for the county to be doing it countywide.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons why the league tries so hard to engage citizens and inform them, you know, that they have access. Here in Franklin County, we're very fortunate. They have a wonderful website. You can go on. You can request your application. You can call. I know the number by heart as well because people call the office very often for that. So, you know, there is a part of that that is the actual citizen's responsibility to go out and seek the information. But we do have to make certain that we provide access to that information so that they can engage.
It's shrinking a lot. We got to take a break here real quick. It's shrinking a lot, but there still is an economic divide when it comes to internet access.
Absolutely.
So I know the website's fantastic, but we do have to take a break. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. We'll be right back.
Thank you. On your drive home, get local updates with the award-winning WOSU News Team.
Apparently she is here at the Congress, and he broke in and she shot him.
But Floridian Jan Avery doesn't believe crime is a problem unique to Columbus.
When you have this many people come in for an event this big, it always draws in the undesirables as well.
Hear the latest in local and national news with All Things Considered on WOSU 89.7 FM.
Good morning. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. 46 degrees in downtown Columbus at 1021. Sunshine this morning, a few clouds this afternoon, and a high of 48 degrees. Clear skies tonight and a low right around 30 degrees.
Support for the State House News Bureau stories heard today on WOSU comes from the law offices of Porter Wright Morrison Arthur LLP, helping businesses and individuals solve complex legal problems throughout Ohio, across the country, and around the world. On the web at porterwright.com.
And now back to All Sides.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about Election Day issues. When you go to the polls today, what are you finding? Give us a call. Let us know. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I'd like to hear your stories. If you have some happy stories, let us know. If you don't, Michael Stinziano, he's the director of the Franklin County Board of Elections. He's here to answer all your questions, as is Deidre Reese. She's from the League of Women Voters of Ohio. And also Daniel Tokaji, he is from the Moritz College of Law. He is their director of elections law at Moritz. Daniel, let's talk about the case that's the Bustani versus Blackwell case. It regards naturalized citizens in Ohio in there.
Yeah, this was a case that I worked on a few years ago with the ACLU of Ohio, which had to do with an Ohio law that was passed in 2005 called HB3. It had many components to it, but one of the components that we thought to be problematic was a requirement that naturalized citizens, right, people who are citizens but who were not born in the United States, who were naturalized instead, that these folks, if challenged at the polls, were required to present a certificate of naturalization. This is not a document that ordinarily one would be carrying around with you. You might have it in a safe place like a safe deposit box if you were smart. But if those voters were challenged, they could be required to present a certificate of naturalization. And we argued, hey, this is discrimination between different citizens based on whether they're native-born or naturalized, and that is directly contrary to the United States Constitution, which provides that all citizens have to be treated equally, especially when it comes to the right to vote. And to his credit, then Secretary of State Blackwell, when we brought this lawsuit, actually wound up agreeing with our position, conceding that this law violated equal protection, and a federal court up in Cleveland subsequently issued an order saying that that part of the law was unconstitutional and couldn't be given effect. The bottom line is that voters, whether naturalized or native born, have to be treated equally in the state of Ohio.
Was that legislation, Ohio House Bill 3 that year, was that enacted in the amid the flurry of legislation that was enacted or at least introduced after the 2000 election? Or was that after 2004?
This was after the 2004 election.
What motivated it?
I always hate to speculate as to the state of mind or sometimes lack thereof of members of our legislature. It was certainly motivated by problems, actual or perceived, that had occurred in the 2004 election. And there were probably aspects of that law, which was more than 300-page laws, that made some marginal improvements in the election. I know that for people like Michael and other election administrators, they also created a lot of headaches. There are some provisions, such as those having to do with provisional voting or voter identification, that are so complex and convoluted that you'd have to be a law professor to figure them out. I have to concede that sometimes even I'm a law professor, but I have trouble figuring out out exactly what some of these provisions mean or keeping them straight in my head. And I can only imagine the sorts of difficulties that poll workers, election officials, let alone voters, have in keeping these things straight.
I would imagine just philosophically, keeping voting simple, easy for everybody to understand, easy for everybody to follow is paramount. But since 2000, it's become more and more confusing. I called it a renaissance earlier when we were off the air, but renaissance is maybe too nice of a word. What's the pejorative for renaissance? Cluttered?
A slow-moving train wreck, perhaps.
Okay.
I don't want to be too negative here.
Sure.
I mean, I think here's the reality. We're a lot more aware of the problems that exist with the dark underbelly of elections than we were before 2000, right? And that's a good thing because when you focus attention on problems, they do tend to get better, not always immediately. But I'm quite confident that despite the perception that some voters may have that things are worse, our democracy and our election infrastructure has actually improved quite significantly and in ways that are measurable at a national level, at a state level, and at a local level in the last 9 years. Things really have gotten better, even though it may not appear that way at all times to the voter.
I would just add one of the things that Daniel said earlier was that there was a perception of problems. And I think a lot of things that happened in House Bill 3 and even some subsequent legislation that's been introduced were perceived problems. You know, we heard all this conversation about voter fraud. But when you look at the actual data, we really did not have a huge incidence of voter fraud. But if you were sitting in legislative hearings, you would have thought that, you know, we had 10-15% of the people who were on the poll books who should not have been there. And that just simply was not the case. So again, I think there has to be a lot of education for people to understand just because there is an allegation of something, it may or may not actually be true, or it may be a fix that can happen. You know, we focus really hard on doing poll worker training and working with the Secretary of State's office to make that information more accessible and get good poll workers in, and we try to recruit to help our county boards of election. If you got good poll workers, you're probably going to really minimize the problems that are happening at the local level. But with things changing, you know, it seems every 10-15 minutes, you know, what can we expect for those poll workers to be able to do?
Michael, are poll workers who've been doing it for many, many years having a harder time with the changes than maybe people are coming in for the first time this year?
It just depends who the poll worker is.
Okay.
I think some of the more experienced poll workers that have been there since the 80s do have a tougher time understanding the new technology and the new rules. Obviously, if you get a clean slate and teach someone the first time, it's a little easier than having them to have to continue to adapt. But we've seen, you know, it runs the gambit of how committed they are, how willing they are to pay attention in the class, as how quickly they'll pick up on what the main point of their responsibility will be.
Okay. If you would like to remark about your experience with poll workers today, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And we have a couple emails right now from listeners. The first one, they say, just wondering, what is the purpose of the authority to vote slip? And I second that question. I've always wondered that, but it's one of those things. As soon as I leave the polling, polling place, I forget about it. What is the purpose?
It helps us to rectify on the books how many people voted on that machine, so we know the total counts at the end of the day. Some people sign the books and leave, and it's just so we can do a quick audit at that precinct before they return the supplies.
It's just another way to count.
Correct.
And then double check.
Correct. And it's not counting votes, it's counting voters. So we know and we can justify and kind of figure out if there's any mistakes or if we have to look farther into contacting a presiding judge over something not matching up.
Because the difference between votes and voters is you may not vote on all the issues.
Correct.
Okay. Another email from a listener. $7.5 million, which is what Michael said the cost of the election so far.
For three elections in 2009.
Right. Sounds like a lot. Would internet voting be cheaper? And is there a way to make it hacker-proof and voter-safe? Daniel, you kind of have that national perspective on what's working around the country. Any ideas?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a fascinating subject. And you'll find, if you delve into the debate over internet voting, some very different perspectives expressed by people. I think on the pro side, the argument is, look, if we had internet voting, it would make the act of voting a lot more simple and convenient and would probably increase participation, which would be a good thing. On the con side, there's the argument, can we really make it secure? And that's a hotly debated question. I think the main context in which in the real world it's come up so far has been in the context of military voting, where, you know, if we had internet voting, it would make it a lot easier for a lot of our service members overseas to participate in election. It's not always so easy for them to do so. And these are people whose right to vote. I mean, we want to protect everybody's right to vote, but we sure don't want the members of our armed forces serving our country to be disenfranchised practically or in any other way. I think there are some real security concerns regarding internet voting. There are also issues about can we really be sure if we have internet voting that the registered voter is actually the one casting his or her ballot, which have created a barrier. But we may ultimately see it.
Well, some states do have completely by-mail voting now, and you're never sure of who's voting by mail either, are you?
Yeah, one state in particular, Oregon
right.
has it. And, you know, folks have raised security concerns. There do tend to be more incidents of fraud with mail voting in one form or another, whether it's all-mail elections or absentee ballots than with in-person voting, because the link between the voter and his or her ballot is severable in a way that it's not when someone actually shows up to vote.
Okay.
But we haven't seen a lot of incidents of fraud in Oregon, the state that has all-mail elections.
Right. Stephen, you're on there. You want to ask about paper ballots?
Yeah. My wife went out to the poll this morning, and they said they didn't have any paper ballots. And I thought that was mandated by the Secretary of State. And she also asked if she could bring her wheelchair mother out there. And they told her that she would have to come into the polling place. And I thought it was mandatory that they had a system where they could go out to the car. Ideally, it'd be a paper ballot, but the electronic voting machine was supposed to be made to accommodate that. What's going on with that?
Okay, so two questions. Should there be paper ballots at the polling place? And also, can you bring the ballot out to somebody who uses a wheelchair?
Two good questions. Paper ballots were mandated for the general election last year. They aren't mandated in counties that are machine reliant. So if someone goes and requests a preference for the paper ballot versus voting on the machine, you're not going to have the same accommodation that occurred last fall. You will see it again next general election for the governor's election. From the League of Women Voters settlement, it's going to be something that voters will see more consistently for at least, I think, till 2013 or 2012.
Mm-hmm.
And the second question was whether or not we have curbside voting. We do have curbside voting. The Secretary of State mandates it by a directive for this election. So we are required to have it. It's something that the Ohio law has been very gray in that you had to seek a waiver in order to provide it. But
in advance, you mean?
In advance.
Okay.
And that was if a polling location wasn't ADA accessible. But it is something that the poll workers were trained on. It's in their manual. And that person would be voting a paper ballot. You can't take the machine out because we need the voter verified paper audit trail, which is kind of the little machine everyone hears chucking along when you hit the buttons. So it would be a paper ballot, and there are specific and step-by-step instructions for those poll workers to make that accommodation.
Stephen, does that help?
I really wish they'd have paper ballots all the way around. I just can't vote on the electronic machines. It just, to me, it's just like voting on vaporware. It just disappears, and you have no idea what's going on. Thank you.
Yes, Stephen.
That's actually incorrect. I know some voters have that perception, but the reality is that electronic voting systems, in terms of the number of votes that are lost, are more reliable, generally speaking, than many paper ballot systems, and equally reliable to what are called precinct count optical scan systems. And it's unfortunate that not to say that there can never be security issues with electronic voting, as there can be with paper ballots. But this is a perception that some voters have, which is simply inaccurate. Your vote will count whether you're voting on a paper ballot or whether you're voting on an electronic voting machine. Don't let the conspiracy theorists capture your mind.
You know, here's my dumb question for the day. I can go and I can gas up at, you know, the Speedway, and I can put my credit card in there, and I can fill up the tank, and I can get a receipt. When I do that, Why can't we? I think that would go a long way, wouldn't it? Why can't you get that?
You can't do that because you can't give voters a record of how they voted. If you did that, it would allow voters to buy and sell their votes. And
so that they could prove, look how I voted.
Prove how you voted. Okay, right. The anonymity of the ballot is a critical component of security and a protection against voter fraud, especially vote buying and selling.
But you can see it on the machines how you voted.
The real-time audit log will show how what you pressed and account for that vote. But then once you hit the cast ballot now, it scrolls up and then there's no way to track that person.
No way to go back.
But you do get a receipt because you do receive a sticker,
well, right.
Which is very important.
Right,
which
right.
I obviously don't have on yet, but I'm going to go and vote after work today. Let's see. Let's take a Representative Dan Stewart. You're on the air. What can we do for you?
Well, I just wanted to comment. I'm, of course, the chairman of Elections and Ethics Committee, and we're moving a bill through committee that we've worked on over the last year, House Bill 260.
In the Ohio House, yeah.
Deals with a lot of these issues. I think the boards of elections do a great job. The league is a phenomenal advocate out there, but we are dealing with like reducing from 14 or 15 different reasons to use provisional ballots down to 3. A lot of other kinds of streamlining, common sense kind of things, some cost saving things to try to reduce some of the problems. I think we've had better elections in the last few years. But we want to continue to, and that's why we're calling it voter enhancement legislation. It would help streamline some things like voter ID, as mentioned earlier. It's a little bit confusing and convoluted. But, you know, they're right. Dan's right. The league mentioned it. The voter fraud in the last 10 years is, you know, you could count on one hand out of tens of millions of votes. I think sometimes that, you know, the perception out there that there's more problems. What we want to do, though, is ensure accurate elections, but make it easier for voters. And, you know, again, have some common sense sort of approaches to this that still allows for protection and security. And I think that's what we've done. We've worked on this over a year, 2 election summits, a conference, hundreds of hours of interested party meetings, and I think we've done a good job of addressing in a real comprehensive way. I was there when we passed House Bill 3. I was the only no vote, I think, at the time in committee.
Just for the record.
There were some good things, but there were some problems from that bill, and we hope to address those. I think some of them have been addressed over time, and we'll continue to work on it. So we hope to have a substitute bill here in the next week or so and vote it out eventually and send it over to the Senate and hope to have a favorable consideration over there. And these folks have all been part of that dialogue, and as have been many other organizations. But I think we've really made some improvements from where we are, you know, in the last few years.
Yeah, and Representative Stewart has really been one of the leaders on this, and he's absolutely right that we need to take a good hard look at these things. And now's the time well before the next big election. If we're going to have changes to our election laws, now's the time when we should be looking at these various issues and considering whether there need to be some legal changes.
You know, that provision in House Bill 3 from before that brought about the Bustani versus Blackwell case, was that ever actually implemented? Did that actually go into practice, or was it stopped before there was an election?
It was stopped before that provision that allowed discrimination against naturalized citizens actually went into effect.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Dan, for calling in.
Thanks.
We got to take a quick break now. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Whenever it's on, the sound is so compelling that I can't not listen to it. I mean, you can close your eyes, you know, but you can't close your ears. And I feel connections with people that I'll never meet, that I'll never see, that are halfway around the world in different countries. My name is Rob Ellis, and WOSU is my source for stepping through the looking glass into new worlds, ideas, and possibilities.
Good morning. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News, currently 47 degrees in downtown Columbus. And in just about 20 minutes, at 11 o'clock, Hour 2 of All Sides will be here. We'll discuss the immigration experience and what it means to be an American with author and NPR commentator Andre Codescu. That is coming up in 20 minutes right here on WOSU 820.
Support for WOSU comes from Integrate, helping to improve business performance through brand design and marketing communications for more than 20 years. On the web at integrateinc.com or at 614-421-0004.
And looking at the weather forecast for today, Election Day, sunshine this morning, a few clouds this afternoon, and a high right around 50 degrees. Clear skies tonight and a low right around 30. For Wednesday, morning sunshine, a few clouds in the afternoon, and a slight chance of rain, a high of 47. The low Wednesday night, 39 degrees. And now back to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's our Election Day edition. I am speaking today in the studio with Daniel Tokaji. He is an associate professor of law at OSU's Moritz College of Law, and he's also associate director of election law there. Also, Deidre Reese, she's executive director of the League of Women Voters of Ohio, and Michael Stinziano, he is the director of the Franklin County Board of Elections. Questions? Comments? Observations, good, bad experiences, we're all ears. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, and we're all eyes. Give us an email, allsides@wosu.org. Right now, Wynn, you're on the air. You have a question about provisional ballots.
Yes, I voted provisional ballot today because I didn't get my address change in time. And, you know, I got a lot of friends that say, you know, you're wasting your time, the vote isn't counted. So I just wondered if you guys could discuss, you know, kind of the fact versus fiction on provisional ballots.
I guess you could say that, tell Mary Jo Kilroy that, right?
Well, that's fair. And you're right. There is a lot of fiction out there with provisional ballots. What people question is, you know, my ballot didn't count because it didn't show up on Tuesday election night when the reports were presented by the media. And what you're seeing on a election night early in the morning are what we call the unofficial results. All provisional ballots do get counted and are included as part of the official canvas, which is the official count, which is really what's important, which is where winners and losers are actually declared, not just election night when the news media comes on.
And, you know, statewide, I think it's something like 80% on average provisional ballots wind up being counted in Ohio. And it's actually a good thing that the state of Ohio allows people, if they've moved but haven't notified their Board of Elections, to go to the polling place at their new address and cast a provisional ballot that should be counted. So, you know, this is a form of voting for people who are transient or who've moved that allows more people to participate in the process. And while, you know, all of the things being equal, it's always better to cast a regular ballot than a provisional ballot. It is actually a good thing that we allow this here in Ohio.
Wynn, did you say why you had to do that?
I just was a little too late on changing my address.
Okay. So. Deidre, are you going to say something?
Right. I just wanted to add to what's already been said that the point of the provisional ballot really is the safety net for the voter. You know, like your situation that you described, having moved and didn't get a chance to change, that's the whole point. The League's concern is there have been some other reasons that we didn't feel necessarily should have caused the person to have to take a provisional ballot. But it really is intended as a safety net so that person can have a ballot cast and it can be counted as long as it is proven that they were an eligible voter.
So Representative Stewart, a little while ago, was talking about narrowing the reasons that you can use a provisional ballot. He said there's a dozen or so.
Correct.
Was that? Talk about narrowing it down to three or four good reasons. What would those three or four good reasons be? Moving?
Changing your name. Maybe okay. You got married and you changed your name.
And to some of the legislation, though, it's going to be an offset. So where before you would be driven to vote provisionally, if we can verify it at the spot at the polling location, the way House Bill 260 addresses it, you'll be casting a regular ballot. So there is an offset. So
okay. It
still will be a catch-all to make sure we have that safety net that the League and everyone supports, but it's just going to transition why if we can find a way to get you to vote regular – that's where the legislation would kick in.
And look, sometimes election officials, and I'm sure that Michael would be the first to admit this, election officials, poll workers sometimes make mistakes. The voter really is registered, but for some reason the poll worker doesn't find that person's name on the list even though the voter's at the right precinct. And in those circumstances, the voter should be allowed to cast a provisional ballot. And if it's later discovered that indeed a mistake was made, that vote ought to be counted.
Okay. You feel better, Wynn?
I do.
Okay. Thanks for calling.
Thanks so much, guys.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Tom, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. I just wanted to really give a hats off to a couple of things. Number one, I think the entire process has been greatly improved in the last couple of years. But I just want to thank the poll workers. I mean, I've done it. But it's a very long day, and, you know, they're getting paid not a whole lot of money to be there. So it really is a sacrifice on their part. It's a contribution to our system. And if anybody feels like they don't necessarily appreciate it, they just got to look in the news about elections in other countries. So
hear.
I just want to thank them.
Yeah. All right. Thank you very much, Tom, for the call.
Hear, hear. And, you know, if anybody's out there wondering what can I do to make our democracy better, a great and very concrete thing you can do is to volunteer to be a poll worker in the next election.
Michael, have we seen any difference in the demographics of poll workers in recent years, particularly with the economy?
Well, one commitment we've made in Franklin County is we have partnered with Kids Voting, mm-hmm. and particularly Kids Voting of Central Columbus. And so we do see a lot more youth at the booth is what we call them within Franklin County Board of Elections. And we place a lot of students. The law was changed so we could put two per precinct. And so you will see younger students at polling locations. But we also included a mailing last year when we mailed our absentee ballot applications out that asked people to be poll workers. And we received a tremendous response. And we're in a fortunate position that we have many, many people on lists wanting to be poll workers. And we just have been working budget-wise, not having as many people out. There isn't as big of a need as we saw last
fall. This particular
fall.
Year. Right. But in next year, once the gubernatorial election,
between the youth at the booth and the call to service, essentially, when we did the mailer last fall, we have seen the demographic shift in Franklin County to a younger poll worker.
Having the kids at the polls last year, a lot of schools canceled school on election day, and that disturbed some people because maybe it's a good thing for kids to see people lined up for hours waiting for the privilege.
Hopefully
voting.
Not ours, but
well, that was kind of the idea, though, is that the line snaked through the school for so long, it's disruptive to the educational process. But that wasn't something that was required. That was a district by district.
It isn't decision. Required. It was something that our board did request, made the suggestion that if jurisdictions were willing to close, that might ease the flow. We knew there would be a significant turnout. Because we ended up doing 250,000 early voters, that turnout wasn't as high on that election day. And so the schools that were open, I think, saw an easy flow like they normally see on other election days.
How much does a poll worker get paid these days?
The base salary, so those that you see that showed at 5:30 this morning and then will leave well after 7:30 tonight will receive $120.
Okay. And why do they have to work the entire day? Why can't you split it up into shifts?
It's something Ohio law hasn't provided us to do. That is something that's come up. It's a recommendation. But I think our preference would be it's nice to have one set of individuals so we can account for what happened at that place the whole day. But it does make for a very long day.
Tired.
A lot of people get a lot of reading done, get caught up on some to-do lists, or at least making the to-do lists. Uh-huh. But they are tired, and it's very exhausting for them by the end of the day.
Dieter, does the league have a position on that, those long hours?
Oh, we understand basically that the state law does not provide for it, and we do think that there is something to be said for consistency with the training and making certain, you know, that person that's there in the morning is going to be there throughout the day to monitor everything. But, you know, do we understand that it's a challenge? Absolutely. Many of our members volunteer as poll workers and judges, so they feel the pain, but they think it's worth
the sacrifice. Is a lengthy day a reason why some people can't do it?
Absolutely.
Okay.
They have other commitments, and you know, to have someone come in at 5:30, be reporting at the site at 5:30 means they're getting up at 4:30 or 5 that morning, and then to go through the closing process, they're there until 8:39. So if you have families, other responsibilities, it does result in certain people that are willing to be a poll worker not being able to serve.
Do you provide them with coffee?
It's a hit or miss. We don't personally provide with coffee, but I am aware that there are some polling locations where they have kitchens, make very good use of that. They enjoy having their potlucks and seeing each other again.
Right. And they have, of course, the ubiquitous bake sale. You know, it's always something I look forward to every year.
Maybe we should speak with the good folks at Starbucks and see if we can arrange for them to make a donation to improve our democracy.
Well, depending on the election, you'll see campaigns, candidates, parties bring out food, bagels, donuts. We saw that last fall.
Right.
Depending on how much money they have to spend.
They
can't give it to voters, but right. They can give it to poll workers, okay. And that's what they normally do is set up as a thank you for poll workers.
Okay. Hey, we got a positive comment about poll workers. If you have a positive comment or any comment at all, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And if you've been a poll worker, give us a call and let us know what your experience was from the other side of the table. Dan, you're on the air.
Yes.
Hi.
Are there any societies or any groups that have an international interest in elections and voting and that sort of thing? Are there any international symposiums that discuss the workings of elections and holding elections? Because my major concern is the electronic voting and computerized software that runs these elections in the United States, and I've understand that in Holland and in Germany, they've discontinued that practice because they don't trust it. And what's your comment on that?
A great question. And, you know, this is an area that I think is a growing area, but it's one on which there's not enough of a, I guess I'd say, an international presence or organization. But I really do think that we in the United States have had a bit of an arrogance about our election system, and it hasn't really occurred to us to the extent it should, that there might be things that we could learn from other countries. And you'd ask specifically about voting technology in electronic voting. There is a group that has an international election conference at which various papers regarding voting technology, including electronic voting, are presented every year that provides something of an opportunity for people from different countries to learn from one another. And if I recall correctly, it takes place in, I think, Switzerland and has taken place the last 4 years. I've been on the advisory board for that and have reviewed some of those papers. But I really think that, and I think this is in keeping with the caller's question, this is the kind of thing we need to see more of, opportunities for the United States to learn from other countries' experience and for other countries to learn from ours.
Okay. Anybody else wants to? Okay, we have an email from Harold. He writes, I am in my 60s and have been in the United States for over 29 years. My son is serving proudly in the U.S. Armed Forces. Yet when I go to vote, I do not understand why do I have to produce 2 or 3 IDs. I am a U.S. citizen and I do have an accent, but I stopped voting 2 years ago due to that kind of insult. You know, we talked about that earlier. Daniel Togaji from Moritz, what do you think about that? I mean,
Well, I don't question that the caller's description of his or her experience is accurate, or rather, the emailer's experience is description is accurate, and it's a shame. You know, I think what's happened, every voter should be required in Ohio to show one and only one form of acceptable identification. If poll workers are asking for more than that, they're violating Ohio law. And if they do so and accord differential treatment to people based on their race, their ethnicity, or the fact that they have an accent, that's discrimination. And it violates not only Ohio law, but the U.S. Constitution. It shouldn't happen. And my recommendation to anyone who believes they've been subject to such discrimination is to call or write their Board of Elections and to make a complaint. The League of Women Voters might also be interested in hearing those complaints. But if you just stop voting without registering a complaint, nothing's going to happen. And the next person who comes along who's got an accent may be discriminated against by that same poll worker.
Yeah, the next email from Trevor, basically the same question, but he wants to know specifically what is needed. Does the address on the voter's driver's license have to match the address in the poll book, et cetera? He says, I've had to argue with my poll workers about these issues every election since 2006. It's frustrating that they don't know the law. And I don't assume that Trevor is a naturalized citizen. But regardless, Deirdre, what are the rights? What should people expect? And Michael, of course, you know, jump in whenever you—
Absolutely. You should show up with a photo ID. Or you could use a utility bill that has the current address. The issue is that we want you to actually be voting in the precinct where you reside. So we know people move and may not have changed their driver's license or things of that nature. But that address where you reside is really what we're trying to match. If you don't have that photo ID, again, you can have a utility bill. You can have a military ID. It can even be your cell phone bill. So, you know, the issue is making certain that you're who you say you are and that you reside at that particular location, because the issues may be different. What you're voting on. If you're having problems, you're here in Franklin County, you actually can call the line that we're on Channel 10 today.
Why don't you give us that number?
That number is 821-1010. You can call there. We can help you answer specific questions, help you even find what your polling location is if you've changed your address and you're not sure.
And that's often a question we get, is that their address on their ID is different than what's in the poll book. If they can verify what's in the poll book is their correct address, then that ID is sufficient. And there is a nuance there that was a gray area when the law was written that's been clarified by directive. And in terms of how we train our poll workers, we've trained them many different ways, and we teach them, and teach them again. And it just seems to be hit or miss that some people pick up the message. But again, I think it's the voters who have really understood what's going to be needed. And, you know, they should ask to talk to the presiding judge. Presiding judge will know where to get the right information if there's any confusion.
Okay, I only have about 45 seconds left. But Lloyd, you're on the air. Can you make a comment quickly?
Make it real quick.
Thanks.
I voted in another county the last time, and I noticed that the good old curtain I used to pull behind me when I voted wasn't there anymore. And today I voted in a different precinct, and the thing I observed was that I could see how the person on both sides of me voted by the way the machines were arranged.
Okay.
I'd still like to see the secret ballot back.
Okay, that was a criticism back in 2004, I think.
Can you tell us what polling location that
is? Yeah, Lloyd, can you tell us the location?
The one previously was in Licking County. The one today was at Summit Trace. In East Columbus.
Okay.
It's a big room, but they had the machine set up so they were side by side.
Okay. Thanks for your call, Lloyd.
All right.
Okay. Michael, we've got just a few seconds, and then I've got to
Remind voters that the polls close at 7:30, that if there are any questions, call our office or go to our website. Both are great places to get lots of information for anything that could come up, or if you have a complaint, also hold us accountable and contact our office.
Okay, that's Michael Stinziano. He's the director of the Franklin County Board of Elections. Thank you very much, Michael. Also with us today, Daniel Tokaji, love your name, an associate professor of law at OSU's Moritz College of Law. He's also the associate director of election law at Moritz. And finally, Deirdre Reese, she's the executive director of the League of Women Voters of Ohio. Thank you, everybody, for being here. This has been All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.